Good afternoon. It is a Monday, April the 10th, 2017. 1:13 coming up on 1:14 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Scott Spears along with you for the last hour of the Now program today. And today we are joined by a very interesting person who has a very truly amazing story to tell. A story that is told in a great book, Assassins, Serial Killers, Corrupt Cops, Chasing the News in a Skirt and High Heels. The author is legendary reporter Mary Nieswender, and a lot of you might be interested in this story because of her 40-year friendship relationship. I'll let Mary define this, with a gentleman we all know very well, Charles Manson. Very interesting fellow. But we're so glad to welcome to these microphones for the first time, and hopefully not the last, Mary. Mary, how are you?
I'm fine. I hope you know that Charlie is hard to get a hold of these days.
Well,
I probably don't have much new information for you.
Well, I tell you, it's interesting because we heard about a month ago, as I'm sure you did, that he's 82. He wasn't doing very well. When's the last time you spoke with Charlie?
It's been several years, but he's written me some letters, and I think he's, you know, he vacillates between being the kind country boy he wants everyone to believe he is, and to the mass murderer who loses his temper and flares, you know, his temper goes totally out of control. And the only time that it really went out of control in our law, I talked to him from the time he was arrested, and then we had actually almost weekly or daily meetings in the prison all during that time period of time, all during the trial and before the trial. So I know him pretty well, but it's hard to follow his changes in temper.
Right now
he is ill. I can tell you factually he is ill. He has had an intestinal problem, and he initially refused to have it operated on a couple of years ago. So I think what kind of that problem, I don't know, but I think it's flared up, and they took him to it's life-threatening, and it took him to a hospital just a few miles, well, several miles away from Corcoran State Prison here in California, where he's been for a long time, and they kept him there for 5 days, and then something strange, the report said that the hospital sent him back to the prison because they could do nothing for him. And that sounds weird to me. And then the warden was quoted as saying, "I'm in his cell to die." And I've talked to a lot of wardens, and they're pretty hard-nosed, but they don't do that. They put him into a hospital cell of some sort. In Charlie's case, it would be doubly protected against interference from the outside, and he's supposed to be lying in there waiting to die. I find that hard to believe. So this morning I put in several calls to the prison, and I can't get through. They won't even let me. It won't even let it ring through. It says it said the mailbox is full and all this bulletin and this stuff, and so I'm going around a different way to see if I can get through to him or the warden to find out if indeed he is on death's door or if he's faking it.
You know, this is interesting, Mary. If you want to contact Charles Manson, a prisoner of a prison, how do you go about doing it?
You have to, in Charlie's case, well, you have to be a friend. Now, Charlie doesn't have any friends that don't have criminal records. So if you're a friend with a criminal record, you can't go in to see Charlie or any other prisoner. But I don't have a criminal record, so that's how I got through. But you just go up to the prisoner, write to the warden, make sure that the person that you want to see wants to see you, because they can turn it down. And then you just go in It's if you have never been into a prison, it's kind of daunting. I remember the first time I went in to see Charlie, and these steel gates. You walk into the visitor's room or whatever. It's just not even a visitor's room, just a little room. You take all your possessions and put them in a little box and lock the door. You can just take your notebook and pencil with you, as I did. And you walk through one door, and then this steel door slams behind you, rolls shut behind you. And so you're in a locked cage with gates on both sides. And it's for someone with claustrophobia, it was pretty bad. And then slowly the other door opens, and you can go in to see the prisoner. And usually they bring him out ahead of time and sit him down at a table and then, lock him in. His arms and his legs are bolted or chained to a big bolt in the floor, so he can't move very well. He can't hit you or kick you or whatever. You just talk to him. But if it's just a minor prisoner, they usually don't do that. They don't usually manacle them to the floor. But if you want to find maybe whatever prison you're going into, whether it's San Quentin or Folsom or any of those, they each have a little bit of, there's a little difference in how you have to manage.
Mary,
so it's not very difficult.
Mary, I want to go back here before we get to that, finish that first meeting with Charles Manson. When did he first enter you're a reporter, you're out in California. When did he enter your lexicon? When did that name first enter your life?
Well, the Tate-LaBianca killings took place, but no one knew at the time it was Charlie. When they finally arrested him, that's when I got into the picture with him. And he was not allowed to see anyone. I mean, no reporters, no... And as I said, if he had a friend or a relative, if they had a prison record, any kind of prison record, whether it's, making an illegal U-turn or whatever, but they wouldn't let you in. With Charlie, he had decided to defend himself, so he was allowed to go into the law library. He could not use the telephone, he could not have visitors, but he could use the law library. And I had connections in the harbor where I knew a lot of seedy characters. And one of them had a friend who was also in the library with Charlie. So I made arrangements. And this was like whodunit. On a dark street in the middle of the harbor, no lights at all. I had to meet this fellow I had never met before. He wanted to talk to me before he'd give me the entry into Charlie. So I met him in a bar. And there were no lights. It was midnight, no lights. And I talked to him for a half an hour or so. And he decided that I was okay and that he would help me. And what he did was he had the friend of his who was who could use a telephone, but was in the law library with Charlie. And he handed when they're both together, he took the telephone and called me at the paper at a designated time that we both knew. And then he would give the phone to Charlie. And by the meantime, Charlie would have slept underneath the table at the law library, so he'd be lying on his back. He's 5 feet two, and he can get along. He can go under a table like that very easy. And the fellow would hand it the phone to Charlie, and that's when I first met him. For about 3 minutes that I had to talk to him, I had to tell him something that would make him think I was better than mom and apple pie, And I don't know what I said, but he decided he would talk to me. And that's, so every time he got a telephone in his hands, which he did all the time because they could smuggle it into Charlie very easy, he would call me or he would write me. And all those many months during the trial, before the trial and during the trial, I had a massive amount of exclusive talking about Charlie's background. And anyway, everything, a reporter, it was like manna from heaven, and I made sure that no other reporters could get in.
When
that was a little cheating, but it meant that the television networks who had written to him. And then Charlie sent me all those letters saying, should I talk to Tom Brock or should I talk to so-and-so? And I kept saying, well, you want if you want to, but I wouldn't if I were you because they'll twist your words or something like that. So I had them exclusively for all those months.
Well, Mary, it's very fascinating. In that half-hour conversation, when you met the gentleman who kind of opened the door to Charles Manson...
I know, I can't hear you. I'm
sorry. Is that a little better? Is that a little... Okay, yeah. When you met the gentleman in the bar who kind of opened the door for Charles Manson, what did he tell you as far as this is going to get you in? This is going to make him talk to you? Or was it just...
All I asked him to do was let me talk to Charlie for 3 minutes. You know, have his friend who was in jail hand the phone to Charlie for 3 minutes, and I'd talk my way into Charlie.
So what do you think it was that did it?
That did it?
Yeah, that made him open up to you. In that,
well, he told me that no one had been able to get to him, no one from the press, because the press was outlawed, and he felt that I had something going for me, and he really didn't like women, but he thought I had something going for me that I could get through, and no one else could. So he had a little bit of respect for me. And I think that held through to the very end.
When you had that first exclusive interview with him, do you remember what he told you, what the first exclusive was?
Oh, no, but I could look up my clips. I can't remember. I remember he was sitting at a table, a regular visitor's table. There was a big pane of glass between us, a thick plate of glass, and so we had to use a telephone to talk to each other through the glass. And he basically, you know, said something like, "Oh, so you're Mary?" And I said, "Yeah, and you're Charlie." And then that sort of made the opening a little easier for me. He started by talking about how a lot of charges are being made against him, and he was nowhere near the killings, and I can prove it because I have 40 people that can test. All that was on that first interview. He was telling the truth. One thing I mentioned to him was, you know, Charlie, don't fill me a lot of baloney, or I'll lose my credibility, and so will you. And he tried to, although he does manage to lie a lot, but he tried to keep it on an open basis. But he talked about not being anywhere near the crimes, which when they were killing the Tate and Frykowski and the Coffee heiress and the Sebring, he was at the Spahn Ranch, which is 40 miles away. He told him exactly what to do, and he waited for them to return from the killings. And the same thing happened with the LaBiancas, the couple, the market owner and his wife. They were there being killed by Charlie's group while Charlie was out walking on the beach with his newest girlfriend, Elinda Kasabian, who then turned state's evidence against him eventually.
You know, Mary.
Now, he had all these eyewitnesses that could say, "No, Charlie was at the Spahn Ranch all this time," or "We were on the beach," and it was true. How he managed to turn a bunch of 16, 17-year-olds into robots to kill has always sort of baffled me, because I know very little about LSD. But Charlie told me he could get his girls, or the boys, whichever you prefer, both, and get them to walk through fire on LSD. So
when you're
if they could walk through fire, they could kill.
When you're sitting with him there the first time, how would you describe him? What kind of person is he?
Well, person, you mean that Charlie?
Yeah, yeah.
you know, Charlie, every time you see him, you see someone different. When I first met, he was the sweetest little, you know, he's 5'2" or 3" tall. I mean, I can't imagine a fellow so feared by everyone who's only 5'2" tall. But he came across as, an honest guy, didn't know why this was happening to him. He put on a great show. And then I waited until his mood changed, maybe not on that particular interview, but I was interviewing him at least a couple of times a week all during that trial, and I'd talk about what happened at the trial, and he'd give his version, and I would print that along with the other versions. But it's difficult with Charlie because he when he gets mad at you, and he got really ticked off at me during the trial when I found a young man that was had heard the shots and the screams coming from the Tate house and could tell me that hour that the killings took place. But he was so frightened, as was everyone in L.A. Everyone had armed themselves, had the guard dogs, the whole house, the whole area was frightened. But he said he'd talk to me, but he didn't want his name used. So that I wrote the story without his name. And then Charlie insisted that I give him his name because that could sway the whole trial. And I wouldn't give it to him, nor would I give it to the prosecution. I kept that kid from getting into any trouble or being killed by not using his name. And that was fine until Charlie decided he didn't like me anymore. And I was driving my son to school one morning, and he said, I lived on a guarded city, rolling hills. This whole city has a Trump kind of fence around the whole city, and you can't get in without going through guarded gates. But there are three hippies came to the door, and Mark was about 12 or so, and he said, and all they wanted were a book of matches, and then they walked away, and the hair on the back of my neck stood up, and I thought, well, Mark, tell me what they looked like. And he described the girls, but the girls all looked the same. I couldn't, there were two girls and a boy. By his description, I couldn't tell which girls there were. But when he got to the boy, he described him perfectly, and it was the one boy that Charlie didn't like. He told this kid, I want you to go by my bed. I want you to lay down there until you die. And the kid tried to do that, but he couldn't get away, so Charlie got him up from the deathbed. And this boy usually wrings his hands as he's talking all the time. It's a habit with him. He just his one hand circling the other one. He's just rubbing his hands together constantly. And that's the description that my son gave of the boy. So I knew it was Charlie's people. I finished driving my son to school and went to talk to my friends at the sheriff's office and asked them to put a couple of cars on patrol around the house for a couple of days until Charlie cooled down. And then I went to see Charlie. And by this time I was kind of furious. And he could tell because I must have stomped rather loudly into the room and started asking what the heck was going on. And I don't think I gave him a chance to say anything, but he kept saying, he kept shaking his head like, it wasn't me, it wasn't me, And so I got up to leave, and I was still screaming at him. And he said, wait a minute, Mary, let me tell you this one thing. It'll never happen again. That's the closest he came to taking responsibility for that, but he could have easily have killed my son. So easy. Because this was pretty bad. So I stayed away from him for a little while until I cooled down, and then went back and continued the interviews.
You know, Mary, that's a very interesting point. This man, as you say, people have put up fences in the neighborhood after this happens. Charles Manson's the most feared man in America. Everybody wants to interview him. You're talking to him twice a week. I mean, how fearful was this? He could have done anything. He had these followers who would have followed him through fire.
They would have, yeah. It was tough. But he told the girls that whatever I wanted, they should do. And they did. You know, when I wanted a mass interview with them up at the Spahn Ranch, the ones that were still out of jail, they were there waiting for me.
What did you find?
I wanted information about something, I would ask them and they would give it to me. They were, you know, they were loyal to Charlie, and if he said I was okay to talk to me, they would talk to me, but they wouldn't talk to anyone else.
When you talked to his followers, what did you find about them? What were your impressions of his followers?
Well, they were all pretty much airheads. That's, I guess, a slang word for radio. They were young. They were 16, 17 years old, some younger than that. And they, it was like a sorority, or a, you know, they were all in the same frame of mind. They all thought Charlie was next to God. They didn't think he was God, as many people say, but they felt he was fantastic, and they would never leave him, and they would do anything if he would. I mean, I can't even repeat it on the radio, but they would do whatever he asked them to do, and then they did it willingly. I don't know why they are thinking of releasing one of the girls on parole, because that's what she would do whatever Charlie wanted her to do, and so did the rest of them, and the ones that went in and stabbed the LaBiancas and then mercilessly the killing on the Tate place was so gruesome. I still remember seeing the blood on the door, and I didn't get a closer look at the inside because it was all, you know, cut off for a long time. But anyway, they were robots.
Why did they do this? Why did this all happen?
Well, Charlie, I don't believe in Helter Skelter. I think that was a made-up thing, and so does Charlie, and so does the girls. But when Charlie had a his music was above all everything else. He thought he was a great musician, and he had a meeting with Doris Day's son, his name Melcher, Terry Melcher, and he lived in what we call the Tate House. And Melcher said he wanted to give Charlie a contract for his music, and he went up and listened to him, and he decided no, he couldn't handle Charlie, so he backed off. Charlie got so mad at Melcher that he threatened him, and Melcher left the Tate House and went to live in an apartment he had rented overlooking the Santa Monica. And the people that moved into the Melcher home were the Tate and his her entourage that she had were friendly with. Charlie just told the girls, told Tex Watson to go down and kill everyone in the house, because that would show Melcher that he wanted a contract, a record contract that he promised. And that basically, I'm cutting a lot of details out, but that was basically it. He went in there, and then when he realized that they didn't give enough, I guess if he needed more killings, they sent him to he picked out a house arbitrarily. He went with the cars, picked out a heart and sent these people in to kill the two people that were in there, and as he walked on the beach. And that was made to look like the first killing, because they wrote on the walls Helter Skelter and Death to Pigs and all this stuff that they had written when they were at the Tate House. And also at a home previous to that of a musician called Gary Hindman, they had killed him. Charlie didn't, but Charlie was there and cut off his ear. And then they left, and he left Bobby Beausoleil and Bruce Davis to finish off the musician, kill the musician. But also the word pig was written on the headboard. So Charlie wanted all these tied together, and they were supposed to be looking for someone, not the ones that were in prison. He was trying to, I'm saying this wrong, but they were trying to put the blame on someone else.
You know, if when this trial's going on and you're writing these articles, how conscious are you at this point of trying to stay unbiased? That just, you know, calling it down the middle.
Unbiased?
Yeah.
I think I bent over to try to do that. In fact, Charlie never saw what I wrote, fortunately. When I covered the trial, it was all down straight. You know, I never leaned over towards the prosecution, nor did I lean over towards the defense. And I think that the attorneys will admit that. Perhaps not Bugliosi, because I had a little misunderstanding with Bugliosi, so he didn't like me. But
would you like to tell us what that was about?
Oh, it was so stupid I can hardly say. It's my habit when I go into a case like this to do a story, a puff piece about the attorneys, the judge, the court reporter, everybody that could be handy to my coverage. I'd go in there and write about what a great attorney Bugliosi was, and his boss before he was fired, what Aaron Stovitz was, a great attorney. And so I wrote about this, and in there I unfortunately said, you know, when you're writing about someone and you have to use an adjective, I reach out for an adjective, and the adjective was balding attorney. I called him a genius in the story. I didn't call him only balding, but I called him a boy genius. And about when I was writing about Bugliosi, I called him balding. I didn't know that was a sore point, and he just came unglued. I couldn't believe it. He wouldn't talk to me. He wouldn't talk to reporters if I was standing with him. He went down to the office to get me fired a couple of times, but never about any biased reporting, except that balding prosecutor. That was the key to it. And he just didn't like me. And he kept saying, you know, you're pro cop, you're anti-cop, pardon me. And I've never been anti-cop. Cop taught me all I know is when I covered the harbor. So I said, I'm such a police lover. I've got cop lover tattooed on my whatever. And then I walked away from him, and we never spoke again.
Did you ever think at any point during the trial that Charlie Manson would not be found guilty?
No.
You always thought he would.
Oh yeah. He was so gay. There was no doubt.
When the day came that the verdict came down, did you speak with Charlie how soon after that?
No, he was whisked away fast. I couldn't get to him, and I tried to get in the back door to my usual, but I couldn't get through that day. But several days later, I got through and sat with him, and he said, "You know, they convicted me. I knew they would. There are all these lies. No one could. You know," he kept saying, "everyone was lying."
You know, Mary, he's regarded as probably the scourge of the 20th century, the most evil man. Why is that? Why do you think he had that stigma?
Well, you know, you have to go back to his background. His mother was a prostitute. He was a bastard child of that prostitute. He never knew his father. His mother was 16 when she left home with her brother, and they started on a sort of a Bonnie and Clyde series of robberies down in the South. He was born in Cincinnati, but he spent most of his time with down South, and so when his mother had Johns in the house, she would sit him on the front porch, whether it was winter, summer, spring, or whatever. She'd sit this little kid, 1-year-old, 2-year-old, to sit on the front porch while she was through working, and that was his whole life. And once she finally got picked up for bank robbery or whatever it was, she and her brother were sentenced to 3 years, I think. So that couldn't have been a bank robbery, but whatever it was, she was arrested for. He was sent to live with his grandmother, and he loved his grandmother, except that she was a Bible-beating, you know, little Baptist, and never danced, never sang, so she was very, very strict with him. So she must have been, in addition to loving her, he got a lot of spankings from her. And then one of his uncles came and took him away, and from then on he went into a boy's home, or, you know, places that the mother couldn't take care of him, and so she'd send him to a boy's home, and he'd run away. And from that whole upbringing, he decided at the age of 12, I think he said, he tried to get away from his mom, and so he left home, and he got a paper route, and he survived by the paper route and stealing a few little things from grocery stores or things like that to keep him going. And his mother turned him into police, and he was back in jail. He's 84 now, I think. I think he's 84. And I think all 70 years of that 84, he's in jail. So when he was in this jail this last time before all this came down, he pointed out to the people that were turning him loose, "You shouldn't turn me loose. You shouldn't." He told me this, though. So, "You shouldn't turn me loose because all I know is prison. I don't know anything else. The prison is my home." So you mix that in with Charlie and what he did because of a record contract. You've got the next thing to a crazy guy.
When the trial ended, what happened then? Why did your relationship continue? And what were the conversations about after the trial?
You know, I was reassigned. I had to leave for South America, and I was gone for a year. And that's when Charlie said, "Write to me, you know. But can you see me writing from South America to Charlie Manson? I probably would have been run out of the country." So I didn't write to him. And our relationship sort of stopped then. When I got back, I went to see him a couple of times, but it wasn't the same.
What was different?
You know, I thought about that a lot. I think he felt I betrayed him by leaving him. You know, he said that several times in his letters. But, you know, I didn't betray him. I just didn't write. And I guess I should have written to him more often. But by then he had interviews set up and everything with other people, so he had the intermingling with the press that could, you know, do him some good.
When you would see him on television, I think a lot of us remember the Tom Snyder interview, Geraldo interviewed him. Is that the guy you know that we've seen on television?
Well, it depends on which interview you're talking about. I think he didn't exactly respect Geraldo, but it depends on the interviewer. You know, if you look at Charlie and you say, why did you kill all those people? He's not going to give you the answer you expect. He's going to show you the door.
Why is he an historic figure? When he dies, it will be a big story. Why is he?
Why is what?
When Charles Manson does die, it will be a big story. Why is he a big story? He's been incarcerated for nearly 50 years. Why is he still known by most kids today?
You know, I think it's because people can't believe that he's so evil. They can't believe... Well, I don't know. I shouldn't even answer that because I don't understand it. He makes himself... When he looks at you, even when he looks at, when he gets mad... He opens his eyes, and he does look like the devil, but he only does that for the cameras. You know, he's playing to the cameras, and I think he's played it to the point. No one else, and there are other mass murders that I've written about, and who are probably worse than Charlie, but they don't have the character. You know, I wrote about the freeway killer. He killed 22 young boys. And dumped their bodies out alongside the LA freeways. He fortunately was executed a couple of years ago, but he didn't engender any fear from anybody. They were just hoping that he would meet his, you know, they would sentence him and thus to die, and they did.
Why has Charles Manson been kept alive? A lot of people are angry about this, that he has been on the taxpayer dollar for 50 years.
Yeah, that's why the death penalty goes up and down like a yo-yo. You know, first the death penalty is okay, then they rescind that, and so there people are going back and forth, not knowing whether they should use the death penalty or not. There's very ardent people that do not believe in the death penalty. I do. I felt that Charlie should have been executed. And I felt that the girls, similarly, they've been in prison for 40 years, but they still killed the people, driving knives into them, and a horrible way to kill him. And they got the death penalty and should have been killed. I think the death penalty should be used sparingly, but I don't know. I leave that to the people who know more about law and order.
When you look back at your life, Mary, and you look at
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
When you look back at your life, and you look at that portion of your life with Charles Manson, do you consider that, as nutty as it sounds, do you consider that a friendship? Did you have a friendship with Charles Manson?
Well, you know, I think about that. I think about that because I could have pulled the plug on him any time. I mean, I knew what he did, and I thought he should die for it. But I knew also about the horrible childhood he had, and I sort of threw that into the mix. I was a friend of his. I was his for a long time because he didn't see any of the girls. They wouldn't let the girls in and to talk to him. So I was his only link to anything halfway normal. But I felt and still feel sorry for him because of his life. He had a miserable life, but then he took the lives of people someone has to be punished for that, and it should be him.
Do you think, if you are able to get your correspondence through
to him,
I
can't hear you.
Do you think he would take your call today if he's able?
We're losing you.
Oh, is that any better?
Yeah, a little louder.
Okay. Do you think he would take your call if it got to him?
Yeah.
And what would you say to him?
I don't know. You know, I really don't know. This is something I've always done off the top of my head. I don't plan these things. Between Charlie, I've run into many, many serial killers and done massive reporting on them. And I don't know. I
do you feel sad about his illness?
But I feel bad about what?
His illness, that maybe he is dying.
No, I think he could have. Well, how do you change your life? You know, that's tough to do. I think he got into the idea of killing. Oh, but I'm not a psychologist. I can't tell. When he realized he can manipulate these girls and men, the way he used them, by a little bit of LSD, a little bit of pot, and they'd do anything he wanted them to do. Now that's pretty sick.
When the day comes that he does pass away and die, how do you think history will remember him?
Oh, probably along the same way we remember Jack the Ripper. He's not going to go down as a beloved little kid. He'll go down as a cruel, conniving killer.
When you think about this, do you ever look back at your life and say, wow, I had the exclusive to one of the foremost stories of the 20th century?
Oh, you know, I hadn't thought about that because I've had so many good ones before and since. You know, I've had some really great stories, not all of them, you know, murders and so forth, but I've had a great life. The best stories on the that ever came along, and he was just one of them. Although I did get a lot of doors open to me when I did the Manson stuff.
Do you regret anything that happened during the Manson case?
Pardon? I didn't hear that.
Do you regret anything during that time?
I don't think so.
Is there a story?
Well, I think I gave Charlie a fair shake, and I gave the public a fair shake. And I'm sure I gave the victims a fair shake.
Do you think... Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay.
Do you think much about the victims?
Yeah, I do. I do. But I, you know, they were all adults, so that's a little different. In doing a story where there are children involved in killings, gets to me that too much. It, you know, you have to be really forgetful when you think about a father that kills his little baby because his wife is running around with someone else, and so he stuffs her head in a paper in a plastic bag and watches her die. You know, I'd like to see him. In fact, that bothers me more than the killing of the adults. I guess the adult, I feel the adults have had their share of life, and the little kids haven't. And there's so many little kids being killed these days. I don't understand people anymore.
If you were still out there reporting, what has changed? You've seen the industry change over the years. What are the biggest changes?
Oh yes, I really have. I wouldn't go into the business anymore. It has been a business that has been controlled now by big industry. That's the reason I quit. I quit the paper at the height of this, my work. I was doing a story about a black athlete that was killed in the Signal Hill jail by cops, five cops, and I was doing that, and I was getting to the point where the district attorney was calling me to check with me if I had any more information. I was right on top of that story, and I was pulled off of it. They said he committed suicide. I proved it wasn't suicide. So they held a coroner's inquest, and the coroner said it could not have been a suicide. So then we were on the way to prosecuting these five cops, but the city of Long Beach was in an uproar. They were incensed at this, and they were, you know, challenging police, and the police blockaded their headquarters and so forth. The people were incensed, and I got called in and said I was being pulled off the story because I was causing too much trouble. And I said, you know, but after about 15 minutes of my temper, I just turned around and walked out of that building and never came back.
It's
so I left my profession that I really loved, and that's what's happening these days. I don't think that the reporters themselves are no longer reporters, especially on television. You know, you've got these young ladies that are experts, political experts, you know, all this, these experts, and I don't think they have the expertise of a high school graduate. And yet they're being pawned off at this. I don't know why this is happening, whether the television stations are trying to save money or what, but their reporters now are not as good as they used to be in the old days.
Well, Mary, I think a lot of people would agree with you. This has been fascinating. The book, again, is Assassins, Serial Killers, Corrupt Cops, Chasing the News in a Skirt and High Heels. Mary Nieswender, I'd love to have you back, Mary, to talk about some of these other cases and also about being a woman in this business very early on. I thank you for coming on, and I hope you come back.
I thank you. Sure will.
Thank you, Mary. Bye. Bye-bye. Very interesting story. Hope you enjoyed that. For this day, this is Scott Spears heading for the dugout. You know, is there any particular reason? I'm glad it does. But